Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 72, we'll be assessing the political mood in Sweden following last week's surprising general election results that swung further to the right.
There will be an ongoing discussion now about how could this happen, what could have been done otherwise. There will be more turmoil in Parliament.
That was PJ Anders Linder, political editor-in-chief of Svenska Dagbladet. And how will the launch of BlackBerry's new tablet compad device this week shake up the market?
It's not just the iPad that RIM has to contend with, but at least three or four other devices from Hewlett-Packard, from Samsung, and others.
That was Hugo Miller, technology correspondent at Bloomberg. And standing in for Rob Bound today, we have a very special guest in our culture section. All the way from Tokyo, we have DJ Verbal of M-Flow fame, playing us a bit of this.
Hey, what's up? This is Verbal. I'm back in London. You're about to listen to Bump Bump by BoA, featuring me, Verbal, off of the M-Flow Inside Works Best 4.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly.
Hello, it's Sunday, September 26, 2010, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Tyler Brûlé, along with Andrew Tuck, and we gave it away in the intro. Rob's not here. We have Hugo MacDonald, and we have Verbal as well from M-Flow later on in the program. Hello, Hugo.
Hello.
Are you happy to see us back?
Yes, it's very nice to be back in the studio.
We've been, Andrew, we've been everywhere, haven't we? It's strange to think that the last time we did this program, we were in Washington D.C. and we've been to New York, we've been to Tokyo, Hong Kong, and looks like you're going to bite that microphone. What are you doing to it?
It was slipping. The little scream was slipping on the microphone.
And I was in Singapore, and now we're back.
I know, it's been the most amazing, crazy week. And somehow, I don't know, it was just great. We went to so many places. I mean, it has every kind of weather you can imagine. We were in a cyclone. We were in a tornado. It felt like...
Your hair would have been very unhappy at the Hong Kong party, Hugo, because... I mean, rarely do I ever want to punch people, but it was a lovely gathering that we had to launch our bureau come shop. But it was I don't know, they were saying it was going to be either, you know, a typhoon on number one on the scale or number eight, and I think it was probably about five by the time I arrived at our party. And we thought that because it's in the Wan Chai section of Hong Kong, that we could do a bit of a street party and no one would, you know, really be bothered. And that's largely what happened, because we had about 250 RSVPs, but the space only big enough for about 100. So it was just people holding drinks and umbrellas out on the street. And it was about 35 degrees. And it was moist is what it was.
It was so hot and soupy. But what's incredible is everyone was just kind of, I guess people in Hong Kong are slightly used to it, so everyone was just hanging out, but we were just like knocked out by it. It was incredible.
No, and you entered into the spirit of it?
I mean, everyone was well into it. And also, everyone was kind of sort of just wrinkled and damp, and no one bothered. And it was nice, actually. And then Tokyo was also great, which was a couple of days before. And as I sort of wrote my column yesterday, I've never seen a collection of gentlemen, probably, you know, north of 70, who looked so outstanding. I mean, there was probably about six or seven, just these most fantastic Japanese gentlemen who showed up, who all looked, well, each one looked better than the one beside them.
Well, I think it's so funny about the kind of Japanese guys of all ages is that there's an ability for kind of a group of them to actually kind of be incredibly dressed up, look incredibly immaculate, but not be too fashion-y. They just look good.
I don't know. The balance is, I try to sort of study it, and I'm hoping, well, at least by the time I hit 70, that I can master it somehow. Are you looking forward to your Japan trip in a few weeks?
Yes, I
when
can't
we
wait.
Dispatch you for Design Week?
I know. I really, really can't wait, actually.
What are you looking forward to the most?
I'm looking forward to experiencing some of Tokyo's legendary retail.
Well, I think it's in legendary nightlife.
And then
we did some legendary nightlife, didn't we?
We were in a karaoke bar until
one of
like
our favorite,
four
one of our
in the morning.
Yeah, it was good.
Will you take me there too?
Yeah, if you behave. I don't want you to give away all of Design Week, because you're going to be chatting about it a little bit later in the program. But just a small heads up: how was London this week?
It's okay. It's very big. And I'll tell you more about that later.
Okay, leave us in suspense.
Yeah.
We'll be catching up with you a bit later in the program to hear all about Design Week. But before that, it's time to go over to Stockholm to hear how the country's adjusting to last week's general election results that saw the nation's far right gain a stake in parliament. With the centre-right alliance led by Prime Minister Fredrik Reinfeldt failing to win a majority, the controversial far-right Sweden Democratic Party have entered parliament for the first time. PJ Anders Linder is the political editor-in-chief of Svenska Dagbladet. Blooded, and he joins us on the line from Stockholm to tell us more. Hello, Mr. Linder.
Hello.
I guess to start, tell us a little bit about the leader. I mean, it's when we sort of look at leaders of the far right elsewhere, they tend to be more sort of pushing sort of, you know, 60. But here we have Mr. Åkesson, who's all of 31 years old. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he's been in politics for a very long time in spite of his young age, and he's sort of renovated to a certain extent this party, which has troubling ideas right now, and it has an even more troubling past. But he has really tried and made some achievements to make it more palatable to a larger group of people. So he's relatively soft-spoken, he's no rabble-rouser, but he's obviously very obsessed with immigration and foreigners.
And would you say that was really the sole message that really that the Swedish Democratic Party had to put across? You know, was it immigration, or were there other lines in terms of reform that also chimed with the Swedish population?
When it comes to reform, I have seen very few constructive ideas from this party. I mean, they raise a topic that other parties have been a bit hesitant to raise. Thus, they have come across as people who are telling the truth and people who are dealing with issues that others find too complicated. But they're obsessed with immigration, and the whole driving force behind the party is xenophobia of various degrees. That goes for the party and the party leadership. When it comes to the electorate, I think that it's a split picture. I think some people really don't like foreigners, think there are too many of them on the one hand. On the other hand, you have a number of different reasons for people who feel that they are excluded in society, who feel that nobody listens to them, who feel that these guys are the only ones who are not part of the media, political establishment and all that. So when it comes to the driving force of the people who are in charge of the party, I mean, that's all immigration. When it's come to the electorate, I'd say it's a more mixed picture.
So where did they win their seats? Are we talking about the suburbs of Stockholm where there's friction? Is it in the agricultural heartland of the country? Where did they win their seats?
They're by far strongest in the south, in Skåne, the area around Malmö, Sweden's third city. They got started there and they built their base there and they get most of their seats there. But they have got seats spread all over the country.
I mean, I guess obviously it doesn't sound like you're thrilled, and I think certainly when we've been looking at a lot of the editorials out of Sweden, you know, there's been shock and dismay that of course they won seats. But I guess on the other side, I mean, some of the things we have been reading as well is that there needed to be a more animated discussion about immigration because, of course, Sweden is very and rightfully sort of proud of the number of refugees and immigrants it lets in, but it does also sort of strike you that there's not the greatest amount of integration at the same time as well. I think you can sort of wander around the streets of many Swedish cities and they still largely look like they are populated by Swedes, and a lot of people sort of remain stuck out in the suburbs in government housing. And did this sort of debate, was it bound to happen?
Yeah, I mean, many people pose the question, why did they enter the Riksdag? And of course, you can pose the question, how come it didn't happen earlier than this? It has happened in many other countries. Political correctness has been a problem when it's come to the discussion on these issues. And too many people have been hesitant to bring up the troubles that are associated with relatively large immigration in Sweden. So that is a factor. But I think the Swedish Democrats, they have no constructive ideas, and they have absolutely no ideas when it comes. They want to lower immigration levels, but they have absolutely no idea when it comes to how the many immigrants that are already in Sweden ought to be integrated. There is very little constructive thought on their behalf. When it comes to integration, there are problem areas where most people come from outside of Europe. Few have jobs. There are parts of the country where there have been troubles with unrest. On the other hand, it's not all problems when it comes to immigration in Sweden. Many people from other countries do very well in Swedish society. If you go to university, you'll find many students in medicine and dentistry and engineering, what have you, that have a Middle East background or an immigrant background. So some people are doing very well in Swedish society, but certain groups are not.
Mr. Linder, it's Andrew here. I wanted to ask a question which is about consequences. It's very interesting that other nations which have followed the same path, Switzerland, Denmark, have found in the global, you know, market, their image is dented, it's hit trade. Do you think there's concern within Sweden that actually when this vote is seen around the world and just how big the vote has been, it could have kind of repercussions for Sweden?
There has been some talk about that and sort of troubled remarks on the line that now we're one of those countries that we've talked about before, like Denmark or Holland or Switzerland for that matter. I mean, when it comes to the extent of this vote, when it comes to the level of, how shall I put it, aggression in their political message, I think they will not make Sweden stand out. I mean, it's not like their Danish colleagues or the populist parties in Belgium or Switzerland for that matter. There has been discussion along those lines, absolutely. But I'm not sure that's the main thing that's on people's minds these days.
So 1 week on, do you think that, you know, obviously there was a little bit of hysteria early in the week and certainly it dominated the front pages of newspapers all over the world. But do you move into week two after this? And is it really almost a situation of it will be sort of business as usual again?
Well, it won't be business as usual for the simple reason that the government that got re-elected without a majority in the Riksdag. So there will be more uncertainty. I think they'll be a relatively strong minority government, so to say, and then also due to the way the Swedish constitution is written. But there will be more turmoil in parliament. That's correct. And there will be an ongoing discussion now about how could this happen, what could have been done otherwise, who's to blame. And that won't go away immediately.
Great. PJ Anders Linder of Svenska Dagbladet will continue to be monitoring your pages. Thank you very much.
Splendid. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Andrew, results sort of aside and the fact that the Swedish Democrats, you know, got these numbers, and I think, you know, we probably would have seen the same story elsewhere. You know, it would be no different had it been, yeah, you know, a Belgium, as much as sort of we've seen what's happened in Switzerland and Holland, as was referenced. When I sort of pose the question, it will sort of be, you know, business as usual. I mean, Sweden has a history of minority governments anyway. So do you think sort of in a moderate society, and I know you posed the question as well, you know, will it affect them? And what do you think personally?
There's quite a few little interesting things going on. I think the comparison with the UK comes up in my mind, where we also had a very kind of closely drawn election, which has formed a coalition here. But what was interesting here, in a way, you know, that you would imagine that kind of immigration issue would be much stronger here. And in the run-up to the election, people thought it would be. People thought that the far right would gain seats in the UK, and they didn't. And it just strikes me, it's often these countries where there's not that much immigration, or where immigrants are very separated from society, that they're the ones where the right actually are doing very well. So you see it in Denmark, you see it in Switzerland. I don't know. It's just, I wonder if they really got into power, whether people would be happy, because there is something about, I'm sure people are tortured about it, but there is something still incredibly, when you meet most Swedes, that they are a kind of people who they don't like to ruffle feathers. We'll see.
Well, it's also interesting because, you know, certainly, and you didn't see a lot of Jimmy Åkesson on CNN or BBC. I mean, there was you know, really no discussion. So it's interesting also, first, surprising to hear that he's 31 years old and as a journalist, had a very long career in government so far. You sort of wonder, I mean, you know, it was a student government. He was, what, 15 years old. That aside, but it's also, as you were saying, you know, they talk about him as being sort of very soft-spoken. I mean, he's not particularly fiery, which seems to sort of go with the Swedish personality.
But it is funny, isn't it, how in all of these countries, you know, in the US, you know, the kind of Tea Party movement, in Europe, the movement of these kind of far-right parties within the Alpine nations, within the Nordic region. The question you say about the media is interesting, because I think actually the media is very bad at kind of knowing how to cover them, because often they find them distasteful, or they think they're going to, you know, put off part of their readership. So what's funny is these parties bubble up almost not commented on. You know? I wonder if that's why they actually do in the end quite well, is because they slightly have free rein, and they're a populist movement that, you know, actually doesn't need the media coverage.
No. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly from London. When we come back, we're going to stay, well, relatively in the high north. We're heading over to Toronto. We're back in a moment. You're back back with the Monocle Weekly here in London. This week, Research in Motion, the parent company of BlackBerry, is expected to debut its highly anticipated tablet device at the BlackBerry Developer Conference in San Francisco. With virtually every major player in the mobile and computer space launching some type of pad device, is BlackBerry a little late to the party, or were they wise to see how the market settled down with the iPad? Hugo Miller, technology correspondent with Bloomberg, broke the BlackPad story in July this year, and he's on the line from Toronto. Hello, Hugo.
Hello, Tyler.
To start, we had a slight sneak preview, and we've seen some sketches floating around, etc. One thing which is interesting is there's obviously been sort of the luxury of time that Research in Motion and the BlackBerry design team have had. The iPad has been with us, since spring. Is this a good or bad thing, or do you think they're a little bit late at this point?
I think you're right to raise the point. They have had time to see what Apple's done right or wrong. I think that the problem for Rin, though, is that Apple has really done almost everything right, and in that time has built up perhaps not an insurmountable lead, at least in the consumer tablet market, but a very difficult lead to come out from a standing start with. So the timing is a tricky issue. And it's not just the iPad that RIM has to contend with, but at least three or four other devices from Hewlett-Packard, from Samsung, and others.
But is this the one that everyone's waiting for? And will all eyes really be on San Francisco because everyone sees that this, no matter what Hewlett-Packard or Samsung does, this is where the big competition is going to be?
I think a year ago, Tyler, you probably could have said that certainly was the case because Android was pretty nascent as a platform, and Motorola and Samsung and the other companies that were designing off an Android platform just hadn't really established themselves. But just in the past year, the sheer inroads that Android has made mean that certainly many eyes, certainly all BlackBerry devotees' eyes will be on San Francisco on Monday to see whether indeed RIM does debut this device, but perhaps not as much as a year ago when RIM had more momentum.
There's a lot of talk about sort of the peripherals, and that a keyboard of some description is going to figure. I guess that it will function as some type of pad, but also that there is a keyboard element. Is there potentially also a bit of a Trojan horse side to all of this, at least from a design point of view? That yes, they go after the iPad and other pads in general, but also they go after a notebook or laptop market as well.
Well, I think they do in the sense that that's where they began life. Jim Balsillie developed an audience for RIM by pounding the pavement on Wall Street, selling bankers on the BlackBerry. So that's a natural fit for them. Certainly, we know that the device will be compatible with a BlackBerry in that you will use a Bluetooth connection. So one possibility, and again, we may or may not learn all the details on Monday, is that as odd as it sounds, you will use your physical keyboard on your BlackBerry to type out messages that will instantly appear on a larger screen on the BlackPad or whatever the device may be called. So certainly, they'll be going after that market. How physically the user will use this BlackPad in combination with a BlackBerry, I think, is still a little bit of a question mark.
Do you think that there's some advantage, and this is open to everyone, it is open to the Samsungs and all of the other players as well, that there's perhaps some kind of marketing value in also playing against the tyranny of Apple, in the sense that so many people have the laptop, they have the iPhone, they have the iPad, they have the iPod, that they don't want all of their eggs in one basket suddenly, that no one wants to be sort of tethered to just one source anymore. And is there value on one side of saying, let's just veer off and go the other direction?
I think people do resent the degree to which they become hooked on iPhone. There are people that are still hooked on BlackBerry. It didn't get the nickname CrackBerry for nothing. But I think those numbers have dwindled from, as I said, a year ago. But I think that's what BlackBerry does have to do, is perhaps cast itself as the anti-Apple, in the same way that the PCs did when the series of ads with the hipster that was an Apple user and then the stodgy guy that was the PC user. And it's just about, I think, saying that yes, there are alternatives. Apple doesn't do absolutely everything, particularly things like running Flash software, which is behind what so many websites use for graphics.
I mean, obviously, this is probably going to be one of the announcements that we're going to hear tomorrow, that this will be a Flash-friendly device. What else do they have to do, though, to really make a proper dent in the market, aside from just offering Flash and potentially a keyboard?
think they just have to offer something distinct. We know that it's going to be a smaller device than the iPad, and one critique of the iPad is it's not something you want to take to the beach, not just because it's valuable and you don't want to ruin it, but it's also a heavier device. It's a bigger device, and there is, I think, a market potential for a smaller device that's something that straddles the smartphone, which can be just a little bit too small at times, and a bigger 9-plus-inch iPad. So I think RIM has to really target that market and then go back to its space and sell them on the reasons that they fell in love with the BlackBerry in the first place, which is security, which is a compatibility with all that Office software that they need.
I mean, do you also touch on perhaps one of the bigger stories, because this, from a communications point of view or from a connectivity point of view, will probably be linked to an existing BlackBerry. This means that it opens up a whole new series of retail channels suddenly for RIM, because it strikes me that you don't have to go, or you won't have to go necessarily to one of the wireless operators to go and buy one of these devices, that you could buy them direct if you wanted to.
That's a good question. That, I think, remains to be seen. You're right in that the primary means for connecting this device will be a BlackBerry. The internet connection will come through the BlackBerry device. So you don't have to deal with all of those carriers and all their rules and requirements on contracts. But that raises the question, how do they go about selling it? It's hard to imagine a BlackBerry store like those spotless, all-white, buzzing Apple stores that you see all over town. But there is a question as to how they get this into the marketplace beyond just selling it online through RIM.com.
Well, maybe there's room for sort of a black sort of nightclub style space, potentially.
There we go. open all hours at night.
I think it's a good hook. Hugo Miller from Bloomberg, thank you very much for joining us. Hugo McDonald, are you going to be lining up for one? Because you're not, I haven't seen an iPad on your desk.
Well, no, and that's something that I find quite interesting, is how few of my friends and colleagues and people in the design industry in general have actually bought into the iPad frenzy.
Mm.
Obviously it's sold very well and there've been a huge number of early adopters. But the one or two people who I do know who own them and use them, just, it doesn't have the same cult appeal like an iPod.
Mm. So even the people that own it are not as obsessed with it in a way?
No, there was a lot of excitement and there was a lot of sharing and playing around with it. But then once the playing stopped, it was a bit lukewarm about what happens next.
I have to say, we have a couple of them floating around the office and there's not that much excitement. I mean, I know we've been experimenting with one as to what the applications might be, but then there's also another one sitting upstairs in another part of the company, and it's become a bit of a doorstop.
Yeah, the times I've seen when it's interesting is when people are doing presentations on it. Mm. I think that kind of ability to walk around, and that's what's interesting. But what I think it's also, what I'll want to see is, there's also this big divide between people who use BlackBerry because really they actually want a working device in their pocket, something that's really for their business, and then the people who like Apple, because as you say, a lot of Apple products are very good at adding that kind of fun element and they appeal to kind of a younger market often. So it'll be interesting to see whether BlackBerry comes out and it does divide the audience who want a tablet into the people who want something for fun and the people who want something for work. Mm.
Oh, as I said, we had a bit of a preview, and it comes down to that sort of work and play thing. And I think when you talk to a lot of BlackBerry users, this is a device which is, it's there for purpose, it's there for work, and even though, of course, a lot of people use and I think we all everyone in our office uses a Mac laptop or desktop for work. When it comes to other things, it's they seem to be a little bit more, at least positioning is a little bit more play.
Yeah. I myself switched from an iPhone to a BlackBerry a month ago, and it's a much, much better work tool.
I think that's because the finance department and Andrew forced you to do it. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly from London. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for our weekly monologue. Here's our design editor, Hugo McDonald.
The 8th London Design Festival is on at the moment, and it's uncomfortably vast. There are 240 events in 150 venues over 9 days. That's more to take in than is humanly possible, even for the most dedicated diehard fan. London's transport infrastructure certainly doesn't help. Despite the organisers' attempts to coordinate the events into manageable geographical clusters, of which there are 8, More time is spent in transit between venues than at them. For an event of this size, you'd think all angles would be covered. But the most perplexing thing of all is that so much is lacking. Crucially, it lacks the local charm of the smaller European design fairs. And it lacks the business clout of Milan, Stockholm or Cologne. Its USP is its sheer size. And sadly, quantity is at the expense of quality. With business thin on the ground, London and the UK don't benefit in any long-term sense. It's churlish, though, just to moan about what's wrong, and far more helpful to say what I'd like to see happen next year. First, I'd cut the districts and focus on curating just two areas. The scale of London and its inherent problems should be hidden, not put to the test. Scaling back would mean cutting out, and that would only be a good thing. The free-for-all feeling of the current model means nothing feels exclusive. You don't get a sense that you're seeing the best of British design. Adding an element of exclusivity with exhibitors pitching to a committee in advance would ensure a neatly curated show. Earl's Court, where the trade fair currently happens, is a sorry destination in an inconvenient part of town. So I'd put this half of the festival in a tent in Regent's Park and limit the stands to 150. Nobody needs or wants to see more. 75 would be allocated to British brands to kickstart interest in British manufacturing again. One of the entry criteria would be that each stand must contain at least one new product launch. Not a new finish or a different size of an existing product, but an entirely new design. Manufacturers could test the water with a new product 6 months ahead of Salone, where they could show a full product family. This would attract buyers, which would attract business. 25 booths would be dedicated to British designers under 30 to showcase the finest students and graduates from the country's world-class design schools. The second area would be the South Bank, which neatly shows off many of the UK's architectural highlights in a short scenic stretch. This is where the more conceptual displays of material and technology could take place. In Tate Modern's Turbine Hall, I'd host an exhibition entirely dedicated to British manufacturing and design. On one long table, from one end to the other, I'd make a physical timeline of the materials and products that tell the story of British design. With no more than a two-sentence caption for each object, this would introduce the notion of design to the general public, providing a perfect starting point for the whole festival and giving a perfect context for its host city of London. Business, heritage, context and education. Despite its gargantuan scale at the moment, these are what the design festival currently lacks. At the moment, it's just big. Next year, it needs to be better. For Monocle, I'm Hugo MacDonald.
God, Andrew, I think we're going to lose him. I think he's going to get snatched up by the city fathers.
God, how good was that? The only thing you didn't cover was the catering.
And how was that?
The catering that I've had so far has also been quite sorry, actually. Actually, there's been some very good British catering.
But sort of just sheer scale, aside, it also sounds like there is a lot of mediocrity. And do you think that, part of the play is, really been to go out and probably to sell into other markets, saying, look at, if you're based in Poland, if you're based in Russia, if you're based in Morocco, come here because, you're going to get a bit of everything. But it sounds like also you're getting a lot of nothing.
You're getting a lot of very mediocre shows by designers who you feel haven't really put much thought into what they're showing. Mm. Or any thought into sort of telling a story or trying to push anything forward. And you flick through the massive catalogue that I've got in front of me and you feel slightly defeated before it's even started.
Do you think it's... It probably sounded like a great idea on paper, and I throw this out to both of you, that there would be this, this week-long festival that does combine, of course, industrial design and also fashion, but it becomes neither one thing nor the other.
Absolutely. And it feels that everybody has sort of run off their feet after one day of events and one night of parties. Mm. And everything sort of grinds to a halt. Nobody can really talk to each other at events after three glasses of champagne on one night. The next night, everybody's run out of conversation.
Andrew, do you think that is the problem? That, I think, obviously we've seen so much of popular culture, trying to, take a bit of architecture, take a bit of industrial design, take a bit of fashion and throw them all together. But maybe they should live in their own silos.
I think there's a few interesting things. One, just listening to Hugo's pitch, it just made me think that maybe they should learn some lessons from Frieze, the art fair, which is much more contained. Mm. And maybe that's because they do have kind of one or two stronger people at the head of it who are kind of really demanding what goes on. And then everyone else kind of falls in line with that. And I think the other funny thing about the Design Week here is that, one, it is actually quite a social thing. It does seem to be an excuse for a lot of parties sponsored by a lot of corporate people. Mm. And And that, you know, that just kind of dissipates, you know, what the actual focus of it is. So that, as you're right, there's no kind of central point at the moment. You think, okay, this is the one thing everybody will go and see, and then everything else is satellite.
Exactly. The thing that upsets me the most, I think, is the fact that despite its scale and its size, nobody really outside the industry knows that it's happening.
Mm.
And that's extraordinary, given there are 8 different parts of the city where supposedly there are 50 events happening in each bit.
But isn't that that's also the curse of anything related to design and fashion anyway, don't you think, is that there's always going to be a drinks company. There's always going to be, you know, someone on the periphery who wants to sort of, you know, ride on the coattails of, you know, a new graduate from the Royal College, you know, who might also be great to design, you know, a bunch of champagne glasses.
Yes, of course. But, I mean, sometimes actually they end up producing some of the more interesting things that do happen.
Mm.
Audi have a very interesting display in Trafalgar Square using robots that type text messages in light. It's very conceptual. It's quite difficult to explain without seeing it. But it is quite interesting, and it does have some message about sort of technology and how 50 years down the line that might be incorporated into design in a wider scale.
Could they type stories for Monocle?
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to have a whole battery of them. What has stood out?
For me, actually, I've sort of actively left behind the ones that have got a lot of press or that I've been pestered about, and have headed to the very small British labels. Mm. And I went to visit a very nice company called Izay yesterday. They work with British architects to make door handles and sort of all the fittings that go into these architects' projects. And it's a really beautiful exhibition of sort of very interesting, carefully crafted design that's all made in Britain. And that's the thing I would like to see more of.
I mean, has there been a lot of the craft mantra this year? Not enough?
No, there has. There's craft. Everybody is doing a bit of craft. But in terms of kind of honest craft and using old foundries or sort of woolen mills from Yorkshire and things, I feel like that's just beginning to creep back in.
Mm. Properly.
Properly.
Not. Right.
I think so. I hope so anyway.
Or there's an investigative piece to be done maybe.
No, definitely. Absolutely. I didn't know that Kvadrat make 80% of their woolen fabrics in Yorkshire. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
It's amazing.
We need a bit of Kvadrat for our next studios, I think, as well.
I'm going to meet them next week.
Okay, good. We'll tell them we're going to be building 3 new studios. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in London, and we're back in a moment. You're back with The Monocle Weekly here in London, where we thought we'd have a bit of an extended culture section this week, because Rob is... Andrew, where is he? He's in Tuscany or somewhere, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's lying back having a glass of rosé as we speak.
As long as that's all he's lying back and doing. anyway, we've invited one of our favourite MCs in the studio. He just happened to be in London. It's Verbal from M-Flow. Welcome.
Hi, how are you guys?
Why are you here? I mean, not in our studio, but why are you in London? Why are you in London?
Am I not invited? No. I am here for the Fashion Week, and I have a brand called Ambush, which I do with my wife, Yoon, and we are collaborating with Cassette Player, a London-based brand, so... We were showing that at the Somerset House, and that's why I'm here.
And how did it go? How was the week?
Oh, it's been pretty busy, just meeting lots of different people. You know, you were speaking about fashion earlier, I think. But, yeah, I've been able to meet a lot of new designers, which has been inspiring. You know, speaking to them on a, you know, just at clubs and hanging out with them and really vibing off of them. It's been a good week.
A little bird told us that there's also a project, not just in London, but you might be doing something in Denmark as well.
Oh, yeah.
Is that public knowledge?
I'm not sure. I have to ask the other person.
Anyway, what I have heard is you're going to be working with a venerable Danish silverware company to maybe do a collection for them.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised that, you know, they called on us. And, you know, because we're like a tiny brand from Tokyo and, you know, independent. So, you know, we were very honored.
Are you wearing anything from Ambush on your fingers? There's quite a bit of... It's not bling, in fact. It's actually all kind of quite matte and subdued. I mean, not subdued either, but...
Yeah.
There's just a lot of it.
Yeah, always. I got some skull rings on my finger right now. This is from the new collection, Skull and Bones. And on my right hand, I got the eyeballs ring. Yeah. We call them the I Got Balls ring. You know, I and the balls, and, you know, yeah. So yeah.
We're supposed to turn this into a musical session. It was great that you could come into studio. And it was, I mean, you did, well, you told me that... lots of good things are actually well, there's always good things happening at MFLO, but you know, things are all on track. We had a nice dinner earlier in the week, and it was nice to see our friend Kylie as well.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy.
That was funny. There was a really good story that Kylie was saying that when she flies to visit her boyfriend in Spain, that she flew Ryanair recently, which I just love the concept of little Kylie on Ryanair. And probably, you know, she's so tiny that it's like a business class seat anyway. but she said it was crazy because she was in the front row and she'd never done it before. And she saw everyone, you know, the trolley came down the aisle and you know, people were sort of pulling out their sort of, you know, their £5 notes to pay for sandwiches. And she didn't really know what to do. And she said, the flight attendant was absolutely mortified because he said, "What are you doing on this plane?" And he said sort of all of his sort of like, you know, gay fantasies and pop fantasies were sort of, and he goes, I can't take your money. So that was kind of great.
Yeah, that's cool. That works.
Now, tell us about MFLO Inside Works Best For.
Okay, so this is the album I just brought through. What MFLO does, just to let you guys know, MFLO is me and my partner Taku, and we produce a lot of artists, and we're like a producer group. But anyway, when we're not doing MFLO, we basically work separately on our own. Where, you know, we produce for other artists. I feature as an MC, blah, blah, blah. But so this is our fourth collective album of works that we've done outside of MFLO for the, you know, during the past year. And it's got some songs that I know Tyler might like.
Okay, so what are you going to play for us first?
The Boa track? I know you like
Bump,
that
Bump.
One. Yeah, Bump Bump. Maybe.
Okay, set us up for us, for people who don't know Boa.
Okay, Boa is like a uber famous Asian artist, you know.
Korean.
Yeah, Korean artist, famous in Korea and in Japan. And, you know, I've done many songs, and one of them, which is in this Works Best For.
Let's have a listen. So that was you and Boa, and that was Bump Bump.
Bump Bump.
Is this Works Best For out already, or is it about to hit the shores of Japan?
It just came out.
Just came out.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to have to beat the shit out of your record company because we keep on trying to like sell this stuff outside of Japan, but it's very difficult.
Yeah, I forgot you can curse on this radio.
Yeah, that's the great thing. You can do whatever you want, which is good. I mean, the idea of these, I mean, obviously, you know, aside from, of course, keeping, you know, your name out there, et cetera, and keeping things fresh, but are you also working on new stuff at the moment?
Yeah, you know, we're just speaking last night, but MFLO, you know, we've been on and off doing a lot of works outside, but we are officially going to be back in the studio trying to come out with new materials next year. So
I like sort of trying to come back. I mean, it's like you Anders, like, why are you going to try to come out with a magazine?
Well, you know, because if you, when you've been working with the same people for like so long, like I've known Taku since fifth grade, like since I was like 10 years old or something, you know, we've been making so many hundreds of songs together. And, you know, sometimes it's been a very intense 10-year period where we focused on multiple albums. So, you know, we're taking about a 2-year break, sabbatical, you know, so to speak. And now we're back. So we'll come out with some new materials next year.
And so that means what sort of you would aim for sort of something, you know, to have a hit by summertime, I would imagine, is important.
Yeah, we'd like to. And yeah, with the record company breathing down our backs, like we got, you know, they hope sooner. Yeah.
Okay. Give us something else off of Works Best For. What else do you want to play?
Okay. Taku worked with Calvin Harris. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Calvin. And he did a remix for his song. So maybe
which one is it?
It's track number 9. Yeah, it's a I'm Not Alone remix by Taku.
Cool. We'll be right back.
alone.
So that was I'm Not Alone, and that was with Taku.
Yeah.
Working with Calvin Harris.
Yeah. Oh, you don't understand. When I play this on the floor, it's murder. It's so crazy. Through the speakers, yeah, it's nuts.
We dispatched you earlier in the week. You went out to Dalston.
Yeah.
How was that?
Oh, it was in this club called The Alibi. Mm-hmm. It was the cassette player and Ambush, our brand's, release party and, you know, the unofficial London Fashion Week after party. And it was packed with, I was talking to some of the locals and they were saying, we've never had so much such like diverse audience. So usually they would have all the grime listeners only in the club or, you know, it's very catered to certain audiences. But last night I heard it was just packed with different types of people and crazy.
Hugo, you're looking jealous.
That's where I live.
You're from Dalston? I hear all types of stuff about The Alibi.
It's a fun place to go. I'd say it has quite a diverse crowd already.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I can imagine during Fashion Week probably ups the ante a bit.
Yeah, it was crazy. I had all types of drinks that I've never heard, like tequila and apple juice. Have you guys ever had that before?
Mm-hmm. Does it have a name?
No, I was like, what's it called? Tequila and apple juice. I was like, okay, that's fair enough. And after we stepped out of the club, you know, I was, you know, baptized with a white ace. They were like, you have to drink this if you're in London. Have you heard of that?
White lightning.
No, it's called the white ace. And they were like, it just tastes like, it's got no sparkles and an apple cider kind of thing. It's like a...
it's very classy in Dalston.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely. Really kind of,
this isn't the club, Hugo, where they woke you up when they were doing the cleaning, where you've fallen asleep.
It was close to it, though. Yeah. Rupert, do you like having... You know, it's interesting you said, you know, having sort of a bit of a sabbatical from doing, let's say, you know, M-Flow sort of, you know, day in and day out. I mean, would you say a lot of your focus right now has been on the Ambush project then and your little adventure that's going to happen in Denmark?
Yes. I mean, I think music and design just goes hand in hand. So designing has been just very exciting for me because I've been very focused on music for the earlier part of my, you know, like since I graduated college, basically. So, yeah, I've been focused very much on Ambush, but I guess I'm coming back around with the whole music thing. I've been hitting the studio a lot, working on my solo projects as well. So it's been an exciting time musically as well.
Do you ever think of taking a sabbatical from Tokyo? Like, I mean, for an extended period of time, like, you know, maybe sort of, you know, rocking up in Dalston.
Yeah, actually, you know what? Dalston is a cool place. We went...
it's a great place. It's just beginning to maybe become a bit too commercial.
Really? Already?
Well, it happens in London a lot. Places start off very nice and then word spreads and then 3 years later it's suddenly... You have all
Japanese pop stars showing up.
Oh, no, that would add some nice clout that's probably missing at the moment.
Yeah. I heard Shoreditch was like that first. It was cool, yeah. And then it became very commercial.
Exactly, it's all moved north to Dalston. Yeah. It's pushing everybody further east.
Wow. But would you ever think about a bit of time in, well, maybe somewhere less expected, or even, you know, going around the corner and saying you want to do sort of 6 months in Seoul or go to Hong Kong? Or
I don't know. That sounds like a good idea, though. You know, I mean, because we really love traveling. It's just so inspiring. And obviously, when we travel, we're only there for like a couple of days at a time, maybe a week. So, you know, it'll be nice to just plant ourselves in a different city and just really get excited. I mean, I would love to just live in London. I mean, I'm not just saying this because I'm here, but...
I'm sure we could find a desk for you.
Yeah.
And for you as well, at least. I don't know. Andrew?
The trouble is you've got such a big crew now. You've got, you know, you'd have to bring your music crew, your fashion crew.
You know, we got internet these days, so I'll just shoot them a few emails.
And also, but with Ambush, is that the production, is that all in Japan?
Everything's done in Tokyo, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Depending on the, like, let's say for the higher lines, if we need to get specific stones or some materials we just can't really acquire a certain amount of in Japan, then we have to import them. But besides that, all the...
But the actual craftsmanship is done in Japan.
Everything's, yeah, in Japan, actually in Tokyo, yeah.
I'd like to see the eyeball factory. Yeah. The I got balls factory.
Yeah, I got balls factory.
We're going to go for a break very quickly, but we'll be back in a moment with a few parting words. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in London, where it's almost time to say goodbye. We've got Verbal and we've got Hugo around the table and we've Andrew. And just before we went to the break, Alex, our producer, reminded us that we didn't do Story of the Week at the top of the program.
Oh, well, and we like Story of the Week.
We love Story of the Week.
I've never done Story of the Week.
Okay, well, I think
I
you need to go first
story.
Then. Verbal, you have to prepare yourself. Everyone's got a Story of the Week. So you have to tell us your... Well, I mean, you sort of told the story before, but Hugo,
well,
hit it.
Last week I was staying in a new hotel that opened in East London recently, that's a renovated Edwardian building, and I was just settling down for the night and dropped off to sleep and then was woken up.
You're in bed, I mean, you're not sort of in a corner in the
bar.
No,
I was in bed.
Okay, just a check.
I was in bed, but the phone started to make very strange noises, so I lay there wondering if I was imagining it.
Your phone or the hotel phone?
The hotel phone.
Okay.
And there's increasingly strange noises. I could hear the buttons being pushed and it was making a gurgling noise. So I switched on the lights and looked at it and unplugged it from the wall and then went back to sleep. And the temperature plummeted in the room quite abnormally. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it's just the winter coming in or something. And then was woken up about half an hour later with this massive clatter. The phone had been flung off the bedside table to the other side of the room.
Ooh.
It was a ghost.
Ooh.
God, and this is a month before Halloween. We should have saved that story. Andrew, what do you make of that?
I see a Mystic Meg page coming in the back of our magazine.
I think so, definitely.
Honestly,
were you scared?
I was really, really petrified. I didn't think I believed in that kind of thing, but something very,
now.
Very strange was happening in that room.
Crystal balls, he'll be. Oh, my God. Frightening.
Time for a paranormal story.
Frightening.
Yeah, actually, I have something. I don't know if it's paranormal, but in Japan, we have this coin, you know, currency for the yen. We have 5 yen where there's a hole right in the middle of the coin. Mm. And, you know, I was just talking to my friends on a just round the table, and I had a string through the 5 yen coin, and I was just swinging it around. You know, mm-hmm. people fiddle with their pens or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, and blah, 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 just talking. And with both of my hands on both ends of the strings, swinging the 5 yen around, the 5 yen just flung towards my friend, and the string wasn't cut.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. Well, I was like, but you know how people reacted? People were like, whoa, that's so cool. Can you do it again? I'm like, I don't know how I did it.
Wow. Okay, Andrew,
We're stuck now, aren't we? What stories can we tell?
I think we're out of time this week, aren't we?
There was maybe space travel or... what did we do?
I know. We did a bit of time travel this week.
I've got a sweet story. My story is so kind of different to your two, but I want a big shout out for your Ukraine this week. Because when I was in Tokyo on Saturday, I was a bit lost at one point, and I saw a kind of...
This is when you're trying to get to Midtown, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think you'd said it's a two-minute walk, and it was a little bit more than 2 minutes, so you might be walking very fast. So I was slightly heading in the wrong direction.
I took a cab.
I know. I bet you did. It was like, okay, how can this be 2 minutes? Anyway, I stopped this very nice-looking couple, and I said, oh, could you tell me how did you get to Midtown? And the guy said, oh, look, yeah, it's quite a long way. Why don't you come with me? I've got my car here. We can give you a lift. So
really?
this nice man and his wife gave me a lift, and we got chatting. And he was, the deputy head of mission for Ukraine.
Wow.
And so the Ukrainian diplomatic staff, and they told me they'd been in Tokyo for like 7 years. And what I thought was great was, I'm sure they're really lovely when they're at home anyway, but you don't associate Ukrainians with going out the way like that.
Mm.
But I think it's that kind of Tokyo vibe. They'd picked up this super politeness and being really nice and saw someone lost. It was great. So I had a trip in the back of their car. They dropped me off at Midtown.
That's nice. Yeah, and you were on time and everything.
Yeah, told me all about the family, about representing Ukraine.
Are they in a rush to get back to Kiev?
No, they were very, very, very happy being in Tokyo. I mean, they're very clear that they were hoping they weren't going to be posted anywhere soon.
Oh. God, now it's my turn for a story.
So thank you, Ukraine.
Yeah. I was flying back on Singapore Airlines on an A380, which is a very quiet aircraft.
Right.
And I don't like when you get on a plane and there's something about Singapore Airlines. I mean, it's probably good for maybe more confident flyers, but I'm not the best flyer. And they tell you that there's going to be sort of, you know, hour two, hour four, and hour seven of the flight that's going to be quite bumpy. But nevertheless, I was actually quite tired from my whole flight. But the plane is so quiet, the A380, that you don't have that white noise. And I'm not talking about sort of, you know, paranormal noise either. you don't have any of that sort of white noise. I mean, you really hear sort of, when everyone's sort of, you know, properly into sleep, you hear every bodily function. It's true, though. I mean, this
is not yours, I'm taking.
No, absolutely not. But the problem is not just your neighbors. I mean, these are people, and, you know, business classes, you know, it's quite spacious in Singapore. So, I mean, people even sort of, you know, five rows back. And then at one point, someone's BlackBerry alarm clock started going off. And at first I thought it was mine, so I was sort of looking under the pillows. And it was sort of, I actually had to get up, had to sort of go down 4 rows. And I thought, you know, should I reach across and turn it off? And then I had to ask one of the nice Singapore girls, and she obliged.
Can I just give you one last thing, a bit of plane etiquette? What would you do if the guy next to you goes to sleep with his eye mask on, but leaves the reading light on above him, and he's leaning against the switch so you can't lean over and turn it off?
Oh, well, I mean, you asked the flight attendant to fix that. But, I mean, that's what I did. I mean, I asked.
That's what I had to do in the end.
Oh, you did. You didn't sort of feel
there was a point where my hand was sneaking down the side of his.
I beg your pardon.
Try and turn the light off. And I thought, I'm going to get caught any second with my hand down.
Was this on BA?
By his trousers.
Was this on BA?
Oh, excuse me.
Well, you know what I'm not crazy about, though, is that, you know, when sort of, you know, public space becomes sort of private space. And I think because people almost feel they're in sort of a bit of a cocooned world. And there's actually a lot of undressing going on in the case. I don't think it's acceptable if you're in your jeans or whatever your business attire is, to then just sort of slip your trousers off and, you know, and then put your sweatpants or your jammies on. And there was a bit of that going on.
Oh, you had a party plane.
Oh, I did, absolutely. Anyway, that's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn on our site. If you're on the US East Coast, remember to visit our new store in New York. And if you're in Brussels, watch for our pop-up project, which is set to launch in the coming weeks. Next week, we'll be right here in London, wrapping up our November issue. But for now, from London, I'm Tyler Brûlé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Hugo MacDonald.
And I'm Verbal.
And what are you going to play out? We're going to play us out with something.
You want to play one of our songs?
Yeah, let's play one of yours. You choose one.
Yeah? Okay. Then we will play Summertime Love by M. Flo.
Cool.
Oh.